Lori, give us a little bit of your background and how you became interested in farming and the organic movement.
My educational background, I went to Purdue University and received a degree in food and biological process engineering through the Agricultural Engineering Department. And that is basically a chemical engineering degree focused on food. My first job during college was with Kraft, so I worked on product development in outside of Chicago. My first job after college was in Australia because my ex-husband is Australian and we moved there after college. I worked for a chocolate company, which was actually fantastic.
It's kind of like Willy Wonka.
So that was very exciting, and the technological aspects of engineering I quite enjoyed.
Yeah.
Then we moved back to the States, and I started working for a large multinational food processing company. And over the course of a few years, I became disenchanted with the food system itself because...
A polite way to put it.
Because of our population, we're going to be relying on large food processors for a long time because of the volume of food we need. Still, I...
Is that true? I'm going to interrupt you there because I'm thinking, you know, I've been reading these articles about huge amounts of food waste, like 40% or even way more than that. And I'm thinking, is that true or is that a myth about these huge food processing places?
We don't have enough people who know how to cook. And
fewer and fewer.
And fewer and fewer do. And the limitations of the local food movement and the number of farmers available to produce food we actually eat will continue to have us relying on having food coming from elsewhere for quite some time. Because of our urban society and so many people being further away from agriculture, even if we pushed a educational program both on food, cooking, farming, it's still going to take a long time before we could produce enough food on a local basis to feed ourselves.
Certainly room for more efficiency, though.
Oh, yeah. The food waste issue is quite a...
It's horrific. Yeah.
Major one. Lots of reasons for that. Getting back to my interest, one of the last projects that I was involved with, and this coincided with starting a family, and the interest one develops when you start a family, and the fact that you're feeding your children and you're responsible for their nutrition.
That's when we get serious. We're likely to abuse our own health sometimes. But when you have little babies depending on you, you kind of stop and think, what am I feeding them?
And you start looking into those food systems a little bit more critically.
Yeah.
I was working on some products in the frozen breakfast arena, and waffles to be specific. And the company wanted us to make the frozen waffle 2 millimeters thicker but no heavier, which from an engineering perspective had me redesigning the waffle irons themselves, which was pretty interesting. But in order to make it thicker but no heavier, from the food science perspective, you were adding some fillers, basically. And it was I don't know exactly what the ingredient was, but it was derived from wood pulp.
Wood pulp. Oh.
So that was, had me thinking, okay, I can't do this because I'm really not contributing, in my mind, to the betterment of either those around me or society in general. So after the birth of my second child, I stayed home. That was about the time we moved to Michigan, and I had started gardening on my own a couple years before then and starting to produce a lot of food for the family and having conflicts with, okay, you have a disease issue or an insect issue and you go to the garden store and you're pointed to, okay, well, you can spray this to get rid of that insect. And I thought, no, there's got to be a better way to do it. And so that got me involved in organic gardening and organic growing, and to supplement the what I couldn't grow, I got involved with the whole local food movement. And at the time, there was a co-op in Pawpaw, and I got involved with that. And so I'd start by buying organic food. And people always say, it's so expensive, how do you do it? And the way to do it is you pick one thing at a time to start buying organically, and pick something that you use a lot of. And in our case, we went through a lot of dried fruit. So I started with organic raisins. And as that became not a problem with our budget, I just added more and more.
Well, and I think we have to rethink those budgets. When you think about your health, your family's health, the health of the earth, and how little of our budget really we spend on food versus what we'll spend on a car, on clothing, on entertainment, you kind of have to look at the whole picture and think, wait a minute, maybe my priorities are off a little bit.
We have decided, or it was decided for us, and we were just convinced of it, that we should have cheap food.
Yeah, there's an issue in there.
And unfortunately, there's two definitions of cheap. And one of them is inexpensive, and the other is low quality. And I think
And wood pulp in your waffles.
I think that's low quality.
So how do you move from that to the main focus of our talk here is that you are now raising sheep on a farm in Allegan County. And that's become something of your art form.
Yeah. I learned how to spin when living in Australia. And I think way in the back of my mind, there was always a desire to have sheep. And because of where we lived in Pawpaw, we didn't have enough space to have sheep. And so I started with chickens and with ducks and with bees. And
the gateway critters.
The gateway critters, yeah. Then I worked for Tillers International for 5.5 years. And so
great organization.
Yes. The sheep were there and I could see them, but because of the requirements of my job, I didn't get to interact with them. So there was always that desire.
Yeah.
And over the last few years, two things happened. My ex-husband and I divorced, and I left Tillers and have a new partner with whom I share the farm that we have in Allegan. And was able to realize my desire to have sheep. And having sheep, though, it's more than just having the sheep for fiber or for meat. We're working towards having our farm be a biodynamic farm, which is a kind of a step beyond organic. And one of the key principles with a biodynamic farm is that all the fertility or a large percentage of it comes from the farm itself. And for that, you do need animals because their ability to convert grass and things that we can't eat into a fantastic fertilizer.
Well, before we got into these huge agricultural farms that, you know, thousands of acres and all of that, and having just one or two specialty crops, farmers used to be these family farms where you had livestock and you had all kinds of vegetables and grains and whatnot. And every part of the farm interacted with each other. You got your manure, you know, all of these type of things. And your scraps would feed the animals, et cetera, et cetera. And it was a self-sustaining little organism. And we've moved away from that. And is that how your farm is moving towards?
We're definitely moving towards that. Besides the sheep, and we have two different categories of sheep. We have a primarily meat breed, which also has nice wool. And then we have the fiber animals, which produce excess boys.
Yeah.
Put it mildly. So we have the sheep, and we have chickens. We have geese. We have bees. We're just raising a few turkeys for ourselves and a few friends this year. So definitely we're trying to be much more self-sustaining. the biodynamic principles, you're using different plants that are added to compost to increase the minerals available, and in addition to the any waste like weeds and clippings of organic clippings of that sort, plus the manure of all the different species. And the idea also is that you move the animals around so that you're breaking any parasite cycles that develop by having a single species of animal in an area consistently over the course of time.
It's hard to live without any kind of spraying, although there are organic types. But when you're doing that kind of rotation that we don't always see in these huge, huge, huge industrial farms, you're getting a natural control of some of those pests.
Yes, it doesn't mean that those pests won't cause problems some years. But also whether you're talking about pests or you're talking about weeds or anything like that, looking really closely at where they occur and when they occur can give you ideas on causes for them. And often insects attack plants that are in other ways lacking in some nutrient, or their immune system isn't as strong as it should be. So by using organic methods and the biodynamic principles, what we're doing is we're feeding the whole farm as organism, and we're feeding, concentrating on developing really healthy soil with all the nutrients available so that the plants that grow from there are going to be as healthy as possible.
Right.
And then that's what we feed the animals, and it's an increasing cycle of health and fertility.
Yeah, and every part kind of interdependent.
Yes.
We talked about food waste before, but there's another issue that I think fewer people are aware of, and that's the waste that we have with clothing, with fabrics in landfills. Was that any part of your consideration when you decided to raise sheep?
Yes, that's been long a consideration. There has been a trend in the fashion industry over the last 20, 30 years where it's called fast fashion. And if you go to a clothing store and see something that you want but aren't a type of person to buy it immediately and said, I'll just check back in a week or two, you'll go back in a week or two and it's not even available on the sale bins. So they want the stores want you to come in often and change over your wardrobe so that you keep buying. But what happens to all the clothes that we're discarding? People feel very good about being able to donate it to the needy. But there's so much clothing that gets either donated or goes directly to the landfill that not even the organizations that sell donated clothing, say just in this country, they can't keep up with it.
Yeah.
So there's an industry of sending those clothing in huge bales to underdeveloped nations, and the people, that's what the people there are buying. And unfortunately, that has a cascade effect where any textile industry in those countries gets destroyed. And the other aspect of the fast fashion is that clothing produces a lot of environmental impacts. And if you want to see images of it, the movie Fast Fashion shows astonishing views of the waterways in countries like Bangladesh and Pakistan and all over Southeast Asia, where so much of our clothing is made. And you can tell from day to day what color cloth they're making by the color of the rivers and streams that they're using for their drinking water, for their cooking water and everything. So I've long wanted to work on relocalizing clothing as a next step from relocalizing food, which I've been involved with for a long time. So a lot of people don't realize the impact of that clothing. So part of my idea has been to start to make more everyday wearable clothes out of fiber from the region.
Yeah.
Instead of just buying high fashion things like a beautiful scarf or other beautiful things that you don't necessarily wear on a day-to-day, wear and use on a day-to-day basis from fibers here.
Yeah.
There are a lot of fiber artists in the greater Kalamazoo area. There's various guilds, Kalamazoo, the Weavers Guild of Kalamazoo, there's a fiber guild in Grand Rapids, and there's a huge community of fiber people that meet at fiber shows throughout the region. There are people making clothing and making yarn and making cloth. So the beginnings of the infrastructure are here. Mm-hmm. There just isn't very few people are making everyday type clothes. And the other aspect is reminding people that if you want the best quality clothing, even if it's an everyday clothing, that you will have to spend more for it, but it's going to last a long time. Yeah.
Just a season, but years and years, perhaps.
Yeah.
It's a different way of thinking. We've moved from buying local for food, and now we have to think about buying local for clothing and start more of a movement in that direction. Talk about your yarns, because I've seen some of your yarns, and the colors are gorgeous. How do you dye them? What is it? You grow plants to get these dyes? What's that process about?
Well, in addition to the vegetables and the food that we eat that we're growing at our farm, I am growing quite a number of dye plants. I started dabbling with dyeing maybe 15 years ago by now and accumulating books, and you go out and there's a lot of plants that can give color to fibers.
Mm-hmm.
There's a much smaller number of dye materials that can give colors that are color fast and light fast and vibrant, because we do like
bright colors. Yeah.
So some of the dye plants that I am growing include Coreopsis, which has some varieties which are native to the United States. The one that I grow is Dyer's Coreopsis, which has yellow petals, but the inner part of both the petal and the center part of the flower is like a deep reddish, mm-hmm, orange color. That's a fantastic dye that has been used for at least hundreds of years.
Mm.
And you can get yellows and oranges from that, even going over towards browns. I'm also growing Japanese indigo.
Mm.
There are very few plants that can make real blue colors, and Japanese indigo is one of them. The other indigo is a tropical plant, and Japanese indigo is a temperate plant, although it is frost sensitive. So you just, like tomatoes, you grow it within the season. I start it early in the inside and then transplant it out. But that produces some beautiful blues. I'm growing madder, which is what was traditionally used to make the red color of the British Army,
mm-hmm,
the red coats. Mm. It was used for those colors, and you can get a whole range of colors from burgundies and brick reds and almost pinks and a gorgeous range of colors that was used in Europe for thousands of years. It's used less so now.
Mm-hmm.
Once cochineal was discovered in Mexico through South America, that was used, and cochineal is an insect that lives on cactuses. And since I do use cochineal, but that is one that's imported, I am looking to expand the range of colors that I can get from plants that I can grow. And madder is used, the root of it is used, and so I'm growing that. Other ones include, I'm not purposely growing it because it grows everywhere, and that's goldenrod. So I'm using those to dye yarns, whether it's hand-spun or machine-spun. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's really popular in knitting and other fiber arts are variegated yarns.
Yeah.
They're quite a bit more difficult to produce with natural dyes.
Yeah, yeah.
And the way I'm doing it is I'll have a skein of yarn, and I'll divide it using just yarn into four parts.
Yeah.
And each of those four parts will get a different mordant. And a mordant is a compound that helps the dye attach to the yarn.
Mm-hmm.
And so if I mordant each quarter a different color, then I can put the whole skein into one dye bath and get basically four different colors.
Yeah.
And then to get it to look variegated, you just change the size of the skein. And
depending on the plant, you're using flowers, roots, leaves?
Flowers, roots, leaves. There are barks of trees, like Osage orange is a native tree, and that can give some fantastic colors. And then there's the insects, whether there's some insects that do blues. None of those, the insects that do blues and the insects that do red don't live here, but they're available. You know how you can get fair trade coffee and fair trade chocolate?
Right, right.
I don't know if there are sources for fair trade dye materials yet. And that's what I would like to find that, because it always concerns me when it comes from a country, say like Pakistan or some country in the world where they're known to have labor issues, human rights abuse issues.
Sure,
and I don't want to support things like that. So finding sources for those dye materials that I would like to use that give me a broader range of colors to produce, and making sure that the people who produce that are also treated fairly is something that,
of course,
I suppose this could expand into a whole business on.
So you've got the sheep, and you turn that wool into yarn, and you dye it these beautiful, beautiful colors. And then you sell it at the farmer's market?
I do sell it at the farmer's market. We have a booth at the Kalamazoo Farmer's Market. It's on the south side of the north part of the U that makes up the Kalamazoo Farmer's Market.
Yeah.
We're next to a couple who sell corn chips and guacamole. And
and you're called, what's the name we're looking for?
The name of the farm is Natural Cycles Farm, and we are in the south part of Allegan County.
And this yarn, when you use it, you can wash it. It's the dye will hold fast?
The dye will hold fast. I have not done any light fastness testing. The reason that the chemical dyes became most popular when they were basically taken up most of the natural dyes fell out of favor was because they are very light fast and very color fast. And natural dyes, regardless of how light fast they are, they will fade faster than chemical dyes. But that's also where you get some more interesting colors. And one of the...
I was going to say, some people actually like that faded look. Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons that I'm trying to narrow down the colors and the dyes that I use. Because dyes that have been around for thousands of years, they're still being used as dyes because they're more light fast and they're more color fast. You can look through books on dyeing and find all kinds of things that produce color, but the ones that have been tried and tested over millennia, basically, are the ones that I'd like to concentrate on. And there's a lot of those.
Well, I'll be looking for you at the Kalamazoo Farmers Market. I'm planning a trip, and I'm going to check you out. What I've seen, like I said, the colors truly are beautiful. So thank you, Lori. Thank
You're
you for
welcome.
Coming in.